Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther is in Ketuvim, one of the five Megillot. Sometime we have to take aside a few minutes to discuss why these five Sfarim are called Megillot. Why do they have that special name? That's not for today. Today we're gonna learn, and we're gonna divide it hopefully into two sessions, doing the Megillah. I'm assuming that everyone's familiar with the basic storyline. We'll quickly go over it. We have King Ahasuerus. He has a beautiful wife named Vashti. He makes two parties. At the end of the second party, he invites his wife Vashti to come out. Chazal tell us he asked her to come without clothing, just with her crown on. She refuses. He gets angry. His advisors give him the advice to have her beheaded, and being fully drunk, he listens to them wholeheartedly, or as much heart as he has when he's fully drunk. He kills his wife Vashti, and after the wine's out of him, he misses her. He starts a pageant, gathers all the beautiful women from all the cities. He feels bad. His wife's dead. He misses her, even though she was disrespectful to him. So he makes a pageant. He gathers all the beautiful women from all the different cities, those that were not yet wed, those that were virgins, those that were wed. He didn't care. He was a very powerful king. And he gathers all the women. There was one righteous girl, a Jewish girl named Esther, also known as Hadassah. And she gets taken against her will and against her cousin's will, Mordechai, her cousin who's been bringing her up since she was orphaned. And even though she doesn't want to have anything to do with this, she is chosen as the queen. And now we have our evil figure in the Megillah, Haman. By the way, Ahasuerus is another evil figure in the Megillah. And we'll get to that when we learn it again, but now we'll just quickly go over it. Haman is, well, before we say that, I'm sorry, one more point. The end of the second parak, our two officers want to kill the king, and Mordechai finds out. Mordechai is the big Talmud Chacham, who's Esther's cousin, and when Mordechai finds out, he tells Esther, his cousin, and she tells the king, and they discover that there was a plot to kill the king, and it gets written in the history books, and those two people, Bigson and Seresh, the two who plotted to kill the king, get killed. A man by the name of Haman is raised above all the other officers, and everyone's supposed to bow to him. Mordechai, being an observant Jew, big Talmud Chacham and a big tzaddik, refuses. And
he's allowed to, though, right?
What?
Well, isn't he allowed to
bow to him? We'll talk about that when we go through it more in depth. Mordechai refuses. Haman gets upset. He wants to wipe out Mordechai. And he is not satisfied with killing Mordechai. He wants to kill out the whole Jewish people. He gets a very quick agreement from Ahasuerus to this decree. Ahasuerus willingly gives him the ring off his finger, which signifies that he has the right to draw decrees now. Haman writes up a decree that Mordechai and all the Jewish people are going to be killed. He draws lots, comes out to the month of Adar, comes out to the 13th, the 13th day of Adar, and the decree goes out. The city of Shushan, their capital, the Jews go into mourning. They realize that even though now it's Nisan, they have 12 months almost, till 11 months and something, till the decree is going to come to be, but that's it. The king decreed that everyone could kill him, anyone who wants. They fast, they wear sackcloth. Mordechai sends word to Esther that she has to do something about this. She has to go to the king. And Esther is scared of going to the king because the king hasn't invited her in a while now. And ultimately she agrees if everyone fasts and davens for her. And she comes to the king. The king extends his scepter, which if it touches the person, that's a sign that the king is pleased that the person came. And if not, then the person gets killed for having invaded on the king's privacy. Well, the king extends his scepter and Esther is accepted. She invites the king and Haman to a feast that night. So the king and Haman come. They have a wonderful feast. And when they leave the feast, Haman sees Mordechai and he's all upset. Again, Mordechai won't bow to him even though everyone else does. He comes home and asks his wife and all his advisors, what should I do? The king loves me more than everyone else. The queen invited me as the guest together with the king to her party. And they all tell him, look, the king likes you so much. So, I'm sorry, we skipped one important point. At that party, Esther told them, tomorrow I want the king and Haman to come again. And even though the king's always been asking me what my nationality is, what my family is, and until now I've kept it a secret, I wouldn't tell you, now I'll tell you. At the second party. So Haman goes off on his way home feeling very good with himself. He sees Mordechai won't bow to him, gets all upset, comes home, and his wife Zeresh and all his advisors tell him, if the king really loves you so much, so prepare a very high plank, a very high tree, to hang Mordechai on it, and tomorrow you'll see that Mordechai is hung, and you'll be able to come to the party happy. You'll get rid of your arch enemy, you'll get rid of Mordechai. Haman likes the idea and starts preparing the tree. That night, Hashem saw that Ahasuerus wouldn't be able to sleep. He's twisting and turning. We'll discuss different reasons why he couldn't sleep. And he called his officers and said, okay, he called the servants, read before me from the history books, maybe I'll be able to fall asleep. They read the history books and the page opens up to the story of Mordechai. And Mordechai saved his life when two people wanted to kill him. And he says, okay, did I ever pay him back for that kindness? And they say, no. And he hears noise outside. He says, who is it? They tell him it's Haman. So Haman comes in. He asks him, what should I do to a person that I deeply love and I owe a lot to? So Haman thinks, boy, the king must be thinking about me. So Haman starts putting a lot on the bounty. He starts saying, okay, let him ride your horse, let him wear your clothing, let him... He gives a whole long list of things that they should do to honor him, and he says they should lead him all around town and call out before him, this is what's done to a person that the king loves him. So the king says, okay, quickly, go do everything you just said to Mordechai. Don't leave anything out. Everything you said, I want you to take Mordechai. Now Haman was hoping to come in and get permission to kill Mordechai. So all day long, Haman, instead of having what he wanted to kill Mordechai, is walking Mordechai around town. Notice the Vena Pochus here, right? We're going to discuss Vena Pochus. Things are opposite from what we think. So Haman thinks that this is the day he's going to kill Mordechai. This is the day that he ends up serving Mordechai. He's walking all around town, calling out, crying out, this is what's done to the person that the king loves him. And at the end of the day, he comes home all wiped out. He just sets foot home, doesn't get a chance to shower, doesn't get a chance to do anything, and the king's servants are there rushing. Haman, hey, what's doing? You're invited to the party. Come, quick. And Haman shows up to the party. At the party, Esther tells the king, I wouldn't want to bother the king, but there's someone who really wants to wipe out not just me, but my whole family and my whole nation. And the king says, who is that? Who dares do that to the queen? And the king and the queen says, oh, none other than him, Haman, the evil conspirer, and the king gets upset. He walks out to calm down. And when he comes back, Haman's falling on the queen's sofa, the queen's seat. And the king says, what do you mean? When I'm home, you want to kill my queen? And an officer, who we don't know who he is, Harvona, says, not only that, guess what Haman's been preparing outside? He's been preparing a high, high tree to hang Mordechai, who's been your faithful servant. And the king says, okay, hang him on it. And that day, instead of Mordechai getting hung on that tree, Haman gets hung on that tree. The decree is not yet out. The decree is not yet over. Haman had decreed in the king's name that the Jews would be killed, and that decree hasn't yet been repealed. So again, Esther comes before the king, and again he extends his scepter, he's willing to hear, and she bows before him, and she begs him to repeal the decree, and he takes off his ring, and he lets Esther and Mordechai send out letters in his name, repealing the decree. Esther and Mordechai give permission to the Jews to fight against their enemies on that day. Again, Vena Pochu, instead of the Jews being killed on that day, the Jews are given kingly permission to fight their enemies on that day, and the king is in full support of the Jews that are going to take revenge from their enemies. The Jews do that on the 13th day of Adar, and then they get word from all the Jews that we didn't touch the booty. The booty is all, we didn't do this for money. And Esther asks the king, give us, in Shushan, the capital, give us one more day to take revenge from our enemies, and the king does that, and that's why we have Shushan Purim. We celebrate Purim. Mordechai and Esther enact Purim for the Jews to celebrate on the day they rested from the fighting. They fought on the 13th, rested on the 14th, so on the 14th we celebrate Purim. The Jews in Shushan, which was a walled city, had another day of fighting. They only rested on the 15th, so they enacted the Jews in all cities that were walled from the time of Yeshua, from the time the Jews entered Israel, all those cities, they'll read the Megillah, they'll celebrate Purim on the 15th day of Adar, remembering that miracle that we had an extra day in the walled city of Shushan to fight our enemies. That's a quick overview of the Megillah. Now we're going to start with an introduction, and we'll go through it a little bit more in depth. I hope maybe a lot more in depth. The world's created, Adam Arishon, we have 10 generations, to Noah, we have a Mabel, the world's destroyed. Where was the world created from? Chazal tell us that there's a rock in Har Abayis, there's Evan Ashtia, there's this rock that the whole world, Hashem started with that rock, and the rest came out from that rock. That's why we say Yerushalayim is the top of the world, right? You could look from any angle on a globe. A globe is round, right? The earth is round. Wherever you're going to look, so you could say, this is the top. You turn a little, this is the top. But Chazal told us that our focus has to be, we start from the base of Mikdash, we start from the Holy of Holies, we start from deep in that Holy of Holies, the holiest place on earth, there's a rock, and that rock goes down to the deepest foundations of earth, and from that rock, the world, well, the world grew. Hashem extended everything from there. And we're going to see that the Megillah has a lot to do with that holy place. We're starting with the beginning of creation. We're starting with Adam Arishon, the world's created, starting with that rock, Evan Ashtia. 10 generations pass, we have a Mabel, the world is destroyed, but we still have earth, just all that was growing and living on earth is destroyed. 10 generations later, we have that great man, Avram Avinu, the father of many nations, father of the Yishmaelim, what today people call Arabs. That's something to be discussed a different time. He has two sons, at least. He has more sons than that, but he has two sons, Yishmael and Yitzchak, and we know that Hashem tells him Yitzchak is the chosen one, and Yitzchak has two sons. Yitzchak has Yaakov and Esav. Now, Hashem told Avram, I want you to know your children are going to go to a foreign land. They're going to be slaves there. They're going to be tortured until they come back to this promised land, then I'm going to give it to them. So Yaakov and his sons, they go down to Mitzrayim. Yaakov is Yitzchak's son. Yitzchak had another son, Esav. Esav isn't interested in taking part in that. So Esav goes off to Seir. Esav has many children. One of his children's name is Eliphaz. Eliphaz has many children. One of his children's name is Amalek. So now we have Amalek, that's Esav's grandson. Amalek is a person. Amalek has many offsprings, and that becomes the nation of Amalek. The same time that Esav is multiplying, Yaakov's family is multiplying. Yaakov, also known as Yisrael, ultimately becomes the nation Bnei Yisrael. They go down to Egypt, they spend 210 years down in Egypt, they come out, Yetzias Mitzrayim, spend 40 years in the desert, and enter the land of Israel. Now Yaakov had 12 sons, one of them was Binyamin. The last son, his youngest son, the only son that's born in the holy place named Eretz Yisrael, this land of Israel, is Binyamin. They entered the land of Israel under the leadership of Yoshua, Moshe Benu's Talmud, right? Moshe took us out of Mitzrayim, spent with us the 40 years in the desert, teaching us and guiding us. We entered the land of Israel, we're under the leadership of Yoshua, Moshe's Talmud. We conquered the land of Israel, but we don't do a really good job about it. We leave a lot of the nation sitting there. Instead of wiping them out, like Hashem told us, or chasing them out of the land, we leave them there. It's very convenient to have nations to tax. It's much easier not to conquer them. And then we enter the period of Shoftim. Judges. One judge after another. There's no king. There's no real leadership. There's one leader. And when he dies, it's not clear who's going to take over. Until we get into trouble. We get oppressed by our enemies. Another leader comes up. That's the period of the Shoftim. It takes a few hundred years until we finally see this isn't working. We ask Hashem, give us a king. There's a man by the name of Kish. Big tzaddik. Kish has a son. Kish is from Shevet Binyamin. His great-great-great-grandfather is Binyamin. So he is from the tribe of Binyamin, and Kish has a son named Shaul. Very tall, very handsome, very modest. When the Jewish people go to war and he's told, go to war and wipe out the nation of Amalek. Shaul goes to war against Amalek, and he doesn't kill Amalek's king. Amalek's king is Agog. So now, Agog is left alive, and he's left alive waiting for the prophet to come and kill him, Shmuel. That night that Agog is left alive, he has an offspring. He has a child. And that child has a grandson and a great-great-grandson until we reach Haman. That's the Haman in our Megillah. So we're going to talk about Haman in our Megillah. When we say Haman ha-Agogi, it means Haman who has royal blood. Haman, who comes from that Agog, who was the king, who Shaul was supposed to kill, and Shaul did not kill. Ultimately, Shmuel killed him. But Shaul procrastinated. Shaul waited before killing Agog. So when we're going to talk about Haman in Armageddon, Haman, Agogi Haman, who's a descendant of Agog, talking many generations before that. We're talking about like 300-400 years before that. Maybe not 400 years, about 300 years before that. So Haman's lineage is from Agog, who came from Amalek, who came from Esau. So that's why we say Haman represents Amalek, because Haman was a direct descendant of Amalek. When we're going to speak about Mordechai, Mordechai is the son of Yair, the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson of Shimi, who was the son of Gera, who was the son of Kish. So Mordechai also comes from royal descent, but not directly. He's not coming straight from Shaul. He's coming from Shaul's nephew, Shimi ben Gera. Who was Shimi ben Gera? Well, Shaul sinned. We just mentioned that. So Shaul's kingdom was taken away from him and given to David, to David, his son-in-law. Towards the end of David's kingdom, David's son rebels against him. And David's on the run. Now remember, Shaul had a nephew named Shimi ben Gera. And Shimi ben Gera, when he sees David on the run, he takes time. Now he's a big Talmid Chacham, he's the head of the Sanhedrin. He goes out of his way to run after David and starts stoning him. He throws rocks at David and his men and he starts cursing him. And he says, David, you know, you deserve this. This is what happens to you. You took the kingdom away from my uncle, from Shaul. This is what happens to people like you. All the blood that you spilled is coming back against you. And at that moment, David's own nephew, Yoav, says, let me go and take off his head. Why should you be cursed by that guy? And David says no. Why does David say no? Because David sees with Ruach HaKodesh, he says, he's going to have Mordechai and Esther. Mordechai and Esther and Armageddon come from that Shimi ben Gera. And David HaMelech says, no, maybe Hashem wants me to be cursed. If such a big Talmid Chacham, such a tzaddik, the head of the Sanhedrin is cursing me, maybe I deserve to be cursed. Don't kill him. And because David spares Shimi ben Gera, we have Armageddon. Because of that story where David, at the low point, his own son is trying to kill him, the Jewish people have turned against him. He has a few select people with him. At that moment when he was cursed, he could have killed Shimi ben Gera and did not. That's why we have Mordechai and Esther and Armageddon. At the same point, because Shaul was weak, at a point which was his high point, the high point of his career, he was the first king of the people of Israel, he did not kill out Agog, the king of Amalek. That's why in Armageddon, many generations later, we're going to meet up with Haman. Now let's skip forward. David has a son, Shlomo. Shlomo has a son, Rechavam. The kingdom is divided, right? Rechavam is king. The people tell him, please don't tax us so much. And he tells them, you want to see who's boss? I'm going to tax you like my father never taxed you before. And they say, forget it. And the 10 tribes leave. And we have Israel divided in two. And from that point to the end of the first temple, basically, we're divided in two. We have a king of Yehuda and a king of Yisrael. We have the 10 tribes with their king. And there's no direct lineage there. Sometimes the king is from here and sometimes from there. There are many rebellions there and the kingdom isn't in an organized fashion. And we have Yehuda, we have the southern part of Israel, which has kings going straight from the lineage of David, straight from David. And usually Ben Achar Ben, one son is king after him, who have a kingly blood ruling over Yehuda, the southern portion. The 10 tribes are taken into exile by the Assyrian Empire. Ashur, Sanheir, the king of Ashur, comes. And slowly but surely, it's a gradual procession, he conquers the 10 tribes and takes them out, probably to the end of island of Crete. It's not clear. It says to Kavta, takes them out to exile. Not clear whatever happened to those 10 tribes. Seems that some of them were able to make it back. But a lot of them, we don't know what happened to them. They are Midrashim. That's not for today. So 10 tribes disappear. Sanheirav thinks he's going to conquer Yehuda. He continues this great empire. We have over here a map. We didn't get to photocopy it. How great the Assyrian Empire was. How much they managed to conquer. You're talking about, almost extending to the Caspian Sea. They reached the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and almost up to the Black Sea. You're talking about almost the whole Middle East and going out in the direction of Russia. So the Assyrian Empire was a tremendous empire. He had no reason to doubt he'd conquer Yerushalayim, but Hashem had other plans, and in the time of the King Hezekiah, Yerushalayim was spared. Tremendous nace. Hashem came to our defense, even though we didn't stand a chance at that war. One generation, two generations, we move forward until we reach the time that the Assyrian Empire is overtaken by the Babylonian Empire. We have a king by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, in his first year, king of Babel, He takes over Nineveh, which is the capital of Ashur, the Assyrian Empire. Now that he's got the Assyrian Empire, he proceeds towards Yerushalayim. And in his second year, he conquers Yerushalayim. He conquers Yerushalayim, and he changes kings over there. He takes the king and says, Yoyakim, you're the king of Yehuda, you're under me. If you'll be subservient to me, I have no interest in destroying the temple. Fine, he leaves Yoyakim alone. Now, this is Yoyakim's fourth year as king, when Yoyakim is overtaken. It's his fifth year. No sooner does Nebuchadnezzar leave Yoyakim, Yoyakim rebels. He spends 3 years in rebellion. Until on the third year, Nebuchadnezzar is fed up, he comes back, and in a three-year war, again conquers Yoyakim, and destroys him. He establishes Yoyakim's son, Yoyakim, and we have another two kings, until finally we again rebel, and again Nebuchadnezzar is fed up, he takes all the Jews out into exile. Now it was a two-stage exile. First he took into exile Yoyakim, said after this rebellion I have to take out all the leaders. He took all the leaders out to Babel, he took them all into exile. And then after the Jews rebelled, even though they didn't have many leaders left, and they didn't have Talmidei Chachamim, he came, he quashed the rebellion, destroyed the first temple, took all the Jews into exile. On our way out to exile, on our way out to Babel, we're told by the Navi Yirmiyah two prophecies. One prophecy says, when Babel fills its 70 years, I'm going to remember you, I'm going to Upakat Yeshem, Hashem says, your remembrance is going to come before me, I'm going to look you up, so to speak. Another prophecy says, when Jerusalem fills its 70 years, then I'm going to redeem the Jewish people. These 70 years, the Goyim were firm believers in that.
Daniel,
we'll get to Daniel. The Jews are in exile under Nebuchadnezzar. They're given horrible treatment. Our king's eyes, Tzidkiyo's eyes are gorged. He treats us very badly. His son, Evel Merodach, takes over, and he gives us much better treatment. He frees our king from jail. He feeds him. We're given better treatment. And then after Evel Merodach, we have Belshazzar. And that is the last king. Belshazzar rules for 2 years, and then the Persian and Medes unite their empires, and together they attack the Babylonian Empire. The first war, there are a series of wars, and then there's one war where Belshazzar is convinced he's won. He goes to his charts and he figures the timetable and he says it's been 70 years since Nebuchadnezzar, the first Babylonian king, was king. The time is up. The 70 years are up. Today began the 71st year. I don't know if today, but the 71st year has begun. He's tremendously grateful he's won this war against the Persians and the Medes, that battle. And that night he throws a great party. He takes out all the vessels that we had in the holy Beis HaMikdash, and he starts using them. And the finger appears and draws on the wall, and no one could read what the writing says, until they call the great prophet, not exactly prophet, the great Talmud Chacham, Daniel, and that story is written in Daniel. Daniel reads the writing on the wall, and he tells him, your time is up. One of his servants hears this, and he says, boy, that must mean that the Persians and the Medes are going to succeed. So Daniel warned them he's going to be killed that night. So Belshazzar put a decree, no one's allowed to be seen outside. If the guards see anyone out tonight, they kill him. So one Midrash says that he himself had to go to the bathroom, and when he went, the guards saw him and killed him. Another Midrash in Josephus Flavius, if I remember correctly, he says that one of his servants saw this as an opportunity to gain favor in the eyes of the Persians and the Medes, and he cut Belshazzar's head and brought it to the Persian Empire, and when they saw that he was dead, they attacked and they won. There's another Midrash that says in the middle of this party that they thought they were partying, they thought they had won, and they got a surprise attack. Nonetheless, that same night when he took out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, he was attacked, and the Babylonian Empire ends. 70 years for the Babylonian Empire, but they didn't figure the 70 years right. They started from the first year the Babylonian Empire existed. The kingdom is taken over by the Persians and the Medes. Josephus tells us that the Persians and the Medes had a deal between them. They said, well, the truth is the Gemara tells us this. The Gemara tells us that their deal was that we're two different nations, but when the king is going to be a Persian, then the second in command is going to be a Mede. And then when that king dies, so then the next king is going to be a Mede, and the second in command is going to be a Persian. So it's always supposed to switch between Persians being on top and the Medes second in command, and vice versa. Well, it didn't last. The first king was a Mede, Darius, Daryavish. Daryavish was a Hamadi, from Madai, a Mede. And the second king already was Parsi, and all the kings from then on were Persian. The Persians never let up the kingdom afterwards. They never kept their end of the deal. Once they got the throne, they didn't give up. Ahasuerus is Persian. Ahasuerus is a Persian king. When we look at the history, there are many discussions, and it's unclear, because just as there were many pharaohs, pharaoh was a common name for king, and Avimelech was a common name for king in the Philistine towns. Among the Persians and the Medes, the name Daryavish, Darius, was a common name for king. So it's unclear when we're talking about which king, because they're all called Darius at different times. When we speak about Koresh, it's unclear, because they're all called Koresh at different times. Koresh is another name they used for kings. And Ahasuerus, it's not clear. It seems like there was one Ahasuerus, but that's not clear. It might be there was more than one. So when we read in Daniel, Sefer Daniel, or Ezra, and we try to follow what happened historically, it's hard to follow. We have, Josephus Flavius gives us a certain amount of insight, and Rashi on Daniel and on Ezra constantly quotes from him. And we'll go with the way Rashi presents it, and that is that after Belshazzar, we have Daryavish Hamadi, Darius from Mede. Then we have Koresh from Persian, from Persia. He's the one that permitted us to go and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. That's recorded in Ezra. No sooner had we started that he got word, hey, these Jews, they're going to rebel against you. You can't let them build their holy temple again. So he stopped the building, and the building was stopped for 18 years. The king after him is Ahasuerus. So Ahasuerus that we're reading about takes the throne at a period where the Jews have been given an opening. They were told to go back to your land, build the Beit HaMikdash. They've gone. And then they were told stop, and now they're waiting to be given permission again. It's a political scene. The people who are in Israel are constantly sending word back to the king. They're plotting rebellions against you. Don't let them do anything. And the Jews are constantly trying to prove themselves faithful to the Persian Empire, asking the Persian Empire, let us rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. This is where Rashi presents it, that the story of Ahasuerus is taking place when the Beit HaMikdash has been begun, after Daryavish and Koresh, and has been stopped. There are different opinions. Not everyone agrees with this. Some say Ahasuerus himself is the same Koresh who stopped the building. He's the one who stopped it, and it was his wife Vashti, who was a granddaughter of that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the ancient king of Babylon. It was his wife, at her behest, at her advice, that he stopped the building of the Beis HaMikdash. She hated the Jews with a passion. There was a tremendous difference between the treatment the Jews got under the Babylonian Empire as opposed to the Persian Empire. The Persian and Medes were much kinder to us than the Babylonians. The Babylonians kept a lot of the Jews in slavery. When the empires changed, then the Jews saw much better treatment under Pars and Madai until ultimately we were permitted to build the Beis HaMikdash. Let's begin. Ahasuerus ruled over the whole world, Chazal tells us. That's Ahasuerus who ruled over the whole world. He's one of 10 kings who all the other kings were subservient to. And he was a big Rasha, as we're going to see, and he had no royal blood in him. He gained the throne. It's unclear how he gained the throne, either by marrying Vashti, but that wouldn't explain it, because Vashti had Babylonian royal blood. In those days, they respected royal blood, regardless of what nation it came from. So, to an extent, that gave him a certain amount of power because he married into the Babylonian royal family. But it seems that he was just very wealthy and somehow he gained the throne. I guess he was a good politician. So, in the days of Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus ruled with a very strong hand. He ruled all the countries as though they were his next door neighbor. Ahasuerus got the wealth of the Jewish people. He got the wealth of the Jewish people because the Persian Empire got the wealth of the Babylonian Empire, which had gotten the wealth of the Jewish Empire. And he ruled over 127 states, Medinot, whatever you'll translate Medina. He made a party. Why did he make a party? So there are different explanations. Either he had just succeeded in fighting a rebellion. Two of the states that were under his command had rebelled, and he had succeeded with his military might to quash their rebellion, so he made a party to celebrate that. Or it was a day of worshipping his Avodah Zarah. Or Chazal tell us he went back to the charts and figured out the years, and he said 70 years are up. He figured the 70 years, and he thought he figured better. He figured from the first time that Nebuchadnezzar quashed the rebellion of Jehoiakim. You remember, he conquered him. He was subservient to him for 3 years, and then he rebelled against him for 3 years, and then 3 years later, they spent 3 years fighting, and then Nebuchadnezzar overcame. So 6 years had passed, and he figured from that time I'm supposed to start counting. So he counted from that time, and figured 70 years are up, the Jews haven't been redeemed, okay. He took out the... he felt secure in his throne, the Jews are no longer going to be taken back, and he made a party in the capital of Shushan, the capital of Persia. It was the third year he was on his throne. He called together all the officers, all the kings of all the lands, he called all the army in, and he wanted to show off his wealth. He showed off his wealth, which was tremendous, not only because he was personally wealthy, but the kingly succeeded, Koresh, was once digging near Tras, and he found 680 copper vessels, I don't know, copper chests, filled with good gold and all kinds of jewels, and Ahasuerus inherited all this, and he wasn't stingy either. We're going to see he didn't mind spending it. So he gathers all the leaders, and he makes a tremendous party. Shows off his wealth. He wears the garments of the Kohen Gadol, and for 180 days he keeps all these kings of their own states busy by him partying. The 180 days are up, and he figures, now I have to honor my own people, the people of Shushan. So he makes a party for 7 days, 7 days including Shabbos, and he invites everyone, invites the Jews, and the Jews come. And according to some opinions, this is the sin that brings on the wrath, which we're going to encounter in the rest of the Megillah. So the Jews come, and they're being served not only good wine and good food and given great sofas and chairs to sit on, but he takes out the great vessels that were in the Beis HaMikdash, and he starts serving the Jews with what was once holy by them, the vessels that the Jews considered to be the holiest. Notice how everything is coming back to the Beis HaMikdash. We began today with that rock, the holiest place in the world, from where the world itself was created, and we're going to constantly come back to that. Ahasuerus is intent on seeing to it that the Beis HaMikdash won't be rebuilt. We'll see that as we continue. And when he makes his party, he's intent on showing that he's conquered that Beis HaMikdash. He takes out the vessels, he takes out everything. The holiest person, the Kohen Gadol, he takes out his clothing and he wears it, and he makes a 7 day party for the locals, for the people of Shushan. He makes it in his forest and his gardens, and he adorns everything beautifully. He brings gold vessels to give everyone to drink from, and a tremendous amount of wine. He brings wine, each person should have the wine that he's used to. And even though they used to have a custom that they'd bring out a big goblet and you'd have to finish that goblet, he said, this party, everyone drinks whatever they want. I want everyone to be happy. He has a wife, Vashti. Now Vashti, we've discussed that she comes from royal blood. She's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. But Vashti had it in for the Jewish people. She hated us with a passion. On Shabbos, she used to call Jewish girls and make them... Now, a Jewish girl is brought up on Kol Kvudah Bat Melech Pnima. The honor of a Jewish girl is like the daughter of a king, that she's inside. She's modest. And she'd make them get undressed and work unclothed, doing all kinds of cleaning wool and all kinds of work that's forbidden on Shabbos. And this was to torture the Jewish girls. So Vashti also made a party, and they made it separate seating so that the Jews would feel comfortable coming. But their intent was that somewhere in the middle of the party, they'd mix the men with the women, and they'd get everyone doing znus. Something like today goes on. Only today they don't start separate seating. So she makes a separate party, and he makes a separate party. And comes the seventh day of the party, Shabbos. He's had his fair share of wine. And he calls his seven officers, and he tells them, go bring Vashti, the queen. Bring her before me wearing only her crown. I want to show everyone how beautiful she is. Chazal tell us, when Am Yisrael sits on Shabbos, and we eat and drink, what happens? We eat and drink together, and we start saying Divrei Torah, we start saying Zmiros, in which we praise Hashem. If a person doesn't have the Torah to guide him, the nations, when they start drinking together, so the first thing they do is they start discussing women. And so what happened at this party was that the officers started discussing women. This one said, hey, the women from my country are the most beautiful. And the other one said, no, you've never seen the women from my country, they're more beautiful. And as they were all discussing, Ahasuerus said, nope, none of you have seen mine. Because all the countries you come from, Persia, Mede, mine's not from any of them. Mine's Chaldean. Mine's a Kasti. She's a Vashti, came from the Babylonian, which was a combined empire between the Babylonians and the Chaldeans. And so he invites her to come out and show everyone else how she's more beautiful than anything they're used to. Vashti refuses. And Ahasuerus gets very upset. His wife sends him back word that she's not willing to come. Pashup Shad is, she says no. But Chazal tell us that she had the same plan he did, and she wouldn't have refused. Only Hashem sought it that on that day of Shabbos, where she would make Jewish women get undressed and work, so Hashem paid her back on that day. And A, it was decreed that she should come, and B, Hashem caused her to have tzaras, leprosy. And she started looking at herself and saying, hey, I can't go out like this. And she refused. Chazal say that when she refused, she said, hey, who are you? You used to be a stable boy by my father. I'm going to come out in front of you? My father used to be able to drink wine the amount 1,000 people drank. That night when he made a party with Daniel, he drank the amount 1,000 people drank, and he didn't get drunk. He was able to talk to Daniel like a sane person. You drink a little bit after 7 days, you're all out of it. You're drunk. When he heard this, he got very upset. So he didn't know what to do. He really was drunk. So he called his Jewish advisors and he told them, tell me, what do you recommend I do? And they knew that they were in a tough spot. If they tell him kill her, then tomorrow morning when he's not drunk, when he'll be sober, he'll be upset at them. He'll be regretful, remorseful, he'll feel bad, he'll miss her, and then he'll be upset at them for giving him that advice. If they tell him don't kill her, well, she deserves to be killed. A woman can't talk that way to the king. So they told him, look, ever since we were sent to exile, we've lost our wisdom. In order for a person to be wise, he has to be calm and in the same place and thoughtful. And we've been taken here and there. You can't trust our advice. You have to ask someone else. So he called his advisors that were close to him, and he asked them, what do you recommend? So these officers who usually advised him, the youngest one, the smallest one, Memuchan, piped up and answered. Chazal tells Memuchan was Haman. But that's a medrash. Pshat is that it's a person by the name Memuchan. There's another medrash, by the way, which no one knows, that Memuchan was Daniel. Yeah, oh, you didn't know. Okay, very good. So Memuchan speaks up before the king, and he tells him, look, she didn't only sin against you, she sinned against all the officers. Because what's going to happen now is that all the women are going to hear what she said, the way she acted to you, and they're going to feel like if the queen can answer the king that way, then I can answer my husband this way. If you recall, those of you that were here Friday, so we saw that even though ordinarily today, when we think to the ancient world, we think then men had respect, right? A woman would never dare speak to their husband this way. On the Puritans' time, they used to have a clamp. That the purpose of the clamp was that if a husband had a claim against his wife, that she spoke disrespectfully to him, that he could take her to court, and the court would make her stand in public domain with a clamp on her tongue, and she'd have to stand there a certain amount of time, and everyone would see this woman who spoke disrespectfully to her husband. So people have a tendency to think that for generations already, women are respectful of their husbands. I don't think it's so. I think that history proves not that way. And we see over here also that the people were worried. If she's going to talk back this way, imagine how all the other women are going to talk back. So you got to do something. All the officers, their wives are going to answer them like this, and they're all going to get upset, and it's all going to be led back to you. They're going to be upset in their homes, they're going to be upset with you. So if the king finds what I say right, if you find it good, then you have to put out a decree the other way around. You have to put out a decree that no one can overturn, that the decree will say, as a result of the fact that Vashti wouldn't come before the king, her kingdom is going to be given over to a different girl, someone else who's better than her. And doesn't say it in the Megillah, but Chazal teaches us that part of the decree was to have Vashti beheaded. Everyone's going to hear this decree, and all the women will have respect for their husbands, regardless of how great or how small they were. So the king, being in his drunken state, thought that's a great idea, and so did his officers. They weren't any less drunk than he was. So they did it. They had Vashti beheaded, and they put out this decree. And the decree stated that the husband is going to force his wife, if they come from two different lands, she has to speak his language. Chazal tells, why was all this important? So we know that Esther is going to be chosen as queen instead of Vashti. But Chazal tells there was more to it than that. When Haman is going to put out the decree that all who hate the Jews can take revenge from them on the 13th day of Adar, so then the people started thinking, why should I wait till then? Why don't I beat him up now? I could get rid of him now and take all his wealth. And Chazal tells the only reason they didn't do this, they were given a permit to do a pogrom. Only the permit said, wait to a certain date. Would anyone think that the king would feel bad if they did it a few months earlier? So Chazal say the reason no one did it earlier was because when they got this message, everyone looked at it and said, this guy must be crazy. He's telling me within my own house what language I'm going to speak with my wife and that she should listen to me. Everyone's wife listens to them. That's what Chazal said, which seems to indicate against what I said before, that their wives did listen to their husbands in those days. So when they got this message, they said, we can't count on him, he's nuts. So when he sent the next message saying they could do a pogrom against the Jews, they said, we can't count that he's going to keep his word here. This man's nuts. Today he says this, who knows what he's going to say tomorrow. And they were proven right, because a short time later, he put out a decree the other way around, just as the Megillah ends. He put out a decree that the Jews could do a pogrom against their enemies. And Chazal say that this decree that went out that made him look like a total fool, the point of it was that the people will see that he sent out a decree when he was drunk, and they'll be able to tell that this guy isn't fully with it, and then when the next decree is going to come out to kill out the Jews, they're going to say, we better wait and make sure that he really means it. Perek Beis begins, the king becomes sober. I think we have another 2 minutes.
Okay.
That's what we asked in the beginning. I was told we have till 35.
Okay.
But, are there any questions?
Sometimes they start like I think right at.
Okay, so we'll stop. Continue next time.
It's up to you, I mean, I don't know.
I don't want you guys to be late. Okay, so we'll stop. Next time.